session of March 2nd, 1977. I'm going back to my lectures. About the problem of these novels in which you find idiorhythmic spaces. And I was brought to my attention several novels. Journaux, his novel Joy of Man's Desiring, which is connected with a community that Journaux tried to set up in 1935. Today I'll tackle an important figure. I called it the enclosure. The issue is about the enclosure, as they said in old French, enclosure, a closing off of living space. As you can imagine, it's a vast file with elements coming from various scientific disciplines. It's a truly multidisciplinary theme. I will here simply list the anthropological functions of enclosure. The phenomenon of the enclosure of space has to be put in connection with an ethological fact, the notion of territory. Depends how fast we'll go. Territory is at the end, maybe I won't reach it. But we have to talk about territories. There are animals that have a territory, territorial animals. It's a safe space for food, reproduction, no encroachment or intrusion from a neighboring animal can be tolerated. They are resisted. Among the animals, we have rodents, carnivores, hoofed animals, primates, some birds, like the robin, for example. For Le Roi Gouran, man is a territorial animal, like the stag and the robin. This concept of territory, of course, if we take it from the general problematic, incorporates the opposition between public and private. There is a whole history to this opposition between the public and the private. There are ideological aspects to it. We find it in the legal defense of the rights to privacy. There is a whole legislation about this. But the basis of this historical and ideological formation is an anthropological foundation. Territory. You can have concentric spheres of private space. You can have, for instance, a big estate that includes a house, that includes smaller territories, like rooms to which not all inhabitants are admitted. We within the room, you have another space, another territory, that would be the bed. For instance, we find this in Proust, Aunt Léonie's territory. It's her bed, it's just her own territory. It includes a table next to the window, and this is an absolutely private space. In many cases, repression in prisons, hospitals, barracks, boarding schools is to prevent privacy. There is no territory. Territory is prohibited. If we think about ethology, we know it's not just about defending one's territory, it's marking out the territory. You have signs. For instance, the hippopotamus marks out his territory with his excrement. He makes a little row of turds and they mark off the borders of his territory. This is what you find in Jean Genet, that some thieves will defecate after they have stolen the goods of the bourgeois family. Well, this is rather banal. The enclosure has a protective function. I just quote this to remember this, as it's a little obvious, but huge. In ethology, architecture, ideology, the transformation of territory into property, protection is transformed into prohibition. From our own specific corpus, let us just note this. Monasteries. The Christian monasteries are to be seen as physically enclosed. You have walls, the boundary walls, and there is a real cloister in the monastic sense. There is a space that is not allowed to non-believers, an area you are not permitted to enter. This prohibition closes off the inner space from the world. The sacred or consecrated space in the middle. You'll see this in Benveniste's studies on the sacred in the Indo-European vocabulary. By opposition, idiorhythmic spaces were less enclosed, with the exception of the béguinage. These were light enclosures or partial enclosures, not very rigorous. Idiorhythmy doesn't aim at protecting a purity. It's not concentration, but dispersion, spacing out, that matters. In our corpus, we have another important description of the protective enclosure. And we see this in Robinson Crusoe. We see Robinson who is alone, who is meticulous, who is obsessive, delirious about his defenses against others. As soon as there's the suggestion of a presence of another man on the island, like the footprints, he takes mad defensive measures. He makes his house completely invisible. There's a whole system of fortifications, of hiding places. We see here the idea of delirium, craziness in enclosure. It is there is then the notion of enclosure as definition. The very meaning of to define is to mark out borders, frontiers, limits. It defines the identity of its occupants. For instance, Buddhist monasteries in Ceylon had buildings that were scattered around a country yard garden. There's no protection, no prohibition. The courtyard garden is in the middle. There's a loose marking out of the space. You generally have fences, double doors, always left open, and beyond that, you have the countryside monastery that is wide open, no doors. The community defines itself but doesn't close itself off. It doesn't prohibit, it doesn't exclude. Another different example, the bourgeois apartment in Zola's Potluck. It's a whole building that is protected. It has locked doors. It has a concierge, a peephole. You have this little opening to see who is at the door. But Zola shows very well it's a complex mechanism of delimitation. The delimitation is identical with its surfaces. The surfaces are charged with the function of announcing the retreat indoors. There is a withdrawal into private spheres. Zola describes in great detail the facade, the doors, the rows of windows. They're all the same. It's a little factitious as a definition, but you have the moldings, the gilt, the velvet carpet on the stairs, the paint, done 12 years ago, already peeling. It's a shared territory, since the apartment building defines the community's mode of being. Within that shared territory, you have smaller territories that are just as exactingly circumscribed. This is the apartment which defines the mode of being of each family. the bourgeois staircase that is described by Zola is a sort of no man's land. When the young woman Berthe has an adulterous affair with Octave, when she's caught with her lover, she finds that all the doors are closed. She's forced to flee down the staircase. She's pursued by an implacable exterior. She's excluded. Every one of the families excludes her from their familial existence. Therefore, the enclosure is a sign system. I'd like to say something now about extreme experience. According to me, the most important question that anthropology raises is not exactly how long has mankind existed. We have this question treated on television. See mass culture on television about the dating of humankind. The specialists would disagree about the exact date, 1 billion years. Or not, when everybody was struck with terror. The real question is this: when, how, or why, not about the physical criteria, when did human symbolism begin? That's the real question. For us, did it begin with man all of a sudden, as Lévi-Strauss would assume? It would be all at once, because you cannot have things that would start signifying gradually. Or did it begin in a manifold manner, in several fronts at once? There would be several symbolic systems that would coexist at the same time. It's just the observation of an amateur here. What seems to be agreed upon is that there is a sort of similarity in the emergence of the main prehistoric manifestations that would have come at the same time. There would be tools, language, and the prohibition of incest. These three main features would be more or less contemporaneous. These are points made by Jacobson, and we know that it has something to do with parietal regular incisions prior to figuration. That would be a sort of writing, in fact, before images, in a sort of rhythm. In that sense, writing would be prior to images. And it would be contemporary with the burial of the dead and human habitation. When we talk about the satisfaction of basic needs in purely functional terms, we know it's never purely functional. We cannot just say that the enclosure is only about protection. It's probably the case, but we have also the issue of sign systems, that is symbolism that was added to it. Enclosure must have been bound up very early with a neurosis. And this neurosis is predominantly obsessive. There are rituals of enclosure. There are extreme experiences of enclosure. If you allow me the expression, there are crazy enclosures. This is an affection term. I'll quote a few of them, of those crazy enclosures. In Robinson Crusoe, who could be seen as the most healthy, rational subject, who is dominated by empirical concerns, but he panics at the prospect of danger. Immediately, he protects endlessly. He endlessly reinforces his defenses. We know that absolute protection is never achieved. It's a mirage. It's always asymptotic. He builds a stockade and then he camouflages it with a thicket, and there is no door. This is also something you find in a novel that has a lot to do with it, The Mysterious Island. The colonists build a building that's very high in a granite wall, and there is a ladder that can be pulled up, the absolute enclosure. Then they even build an elevator. In these attitudes of excessive enclosure, we find something that becomes a symbolic behavior, burying oneself below ground, walling oneself up, and not just the empirical fact of protecting oneself. Symbolically speaking, there is no other absolute protection but one's mother's womb. To go outside is to be defenseless, but that's life itself. These delirious enclosures have a function, preventing the enemy from entering, but because of this neurotic exaggeration, it transforms itself into the self-imposed impossibility of going out. Many anachorites would shut themselves up in the huts. They would only talk to visitors through a little window. diatouridos in Greek. You have the Losiac history about Egyptian monks. You have a monk, Dorotheus, the successor of Elias, who had to oversee a women's monastery from afar. He was shut up in an attic in a barn with no ladder, but he had there a window overlooking the monastery. He would sit there exhorting the women not to quarrel. We now reach the great forms of the madness of the enclosure or self-sequestration. I'll give you two examples. You know these in advance. The first is the case of a stylite, the most famous of all, Simeon the Stylite. I'll tell you the story. He was the son of a shepherd. He lived in Syria and Cilicia, that is southeast Anatolia, at the beginning of the 5th century, 390 to 459. Since he was a young man, he was animated by a passion for asceticism, and it would manifest itself by self-sequestration. He began by burying himself up to his head in a garden ditch for a whole summer. Then he spent 40 days in a cave with no light. Yeah, one understands that the monastery tried to get rid of him. He walled himself up. He had the door cemented over, 40 days without food. In 423, near Antioch, he set up his home on top of a pillar. It was a truncated column. This pillar was initially a low one, but it got gradually raised up. In 430, it was 40 cubits high, 20 meters. He would live on top of it. He built around the little platform a balustrade. From this balustrade, he incited the emperor against the Jews. It's a performance, an athletic performance of the anachorete. Who can wall themselves up the most effectively or the longest? Reclusion becomes a feat. The Cenobitism was instituted precisely to limit this excess. This corresponded to what the Benedictine would call the best virtue, discretion. Let's call up that in Dostoevsky's The Possessed, we have Lisaveta, the fool for Christ, She's been living in a sort of cage for 17 years without speaking to anyone, without washing, without combing her hair. This isn't far, of course, according to our criteria, to pure psychosis. The secular self-confinement is what you have in the confined woman of Poitiers. We're not sure whether it was a voluntary sequestration or whether it was imposed by the family. Mélanie was the name of the recluse. There was a trial. Gide's book is about the documents, and he shows that they were all partially responsible. In this bourgeois family, you'd see the whole family in Poitiers caught up in the collective madness of confinement. The grandfather on mother's side, Monsieur de Chartreux, was also a voluntary recluse in his bedroom. It was a total reclusion. He didn't come out of his bedroom when his son-in-law died in the next room. It was a big bourgeois house with a grand front door that's always locked. What is it that would have triggered the process of sequestration? When she was a young woman, Mélanie was an exhibitionist. She was in the habit of standing naked at the window. So then they boarded up the windows. These are true facts. It's an absolute enclosure for 25 years. The absolute enclosure of the bedroom. The shutters were closed. The second floor casement window was padlocked. The shutters were chained shut. The window could not open. When the police came to open the window, they had to remove the window from its hinges. She would never wash. All the excrements were there. There was an unbearable stench. Filth, excrement, rats. Nevertheless, a maid used to sleep in a room on a little iron bed. The stench was so unbearable that the maid would ask the door to be opened, but the mother would forbid it. She said that we wanted to make her daughter catch cold. Mélanie herself provided the secret key. A deepest and most singular compulsion at the center of the sequestration was her blanket. That was a mother's statement. She didn't want to sleep with sheets. She refused to wear a nightdress. She was only happy when she was entirely covered by a blanket. And then she had a passion for covering herself up. The subtle theme of the blanket over a naked body. As you know, monks were forbidden to sleep naked. This distances the body from the protocols of the family, from the domesticity of bedtime, of going to bed. The blanket is the veil that envelops and blocks out the light. You know, like children burying themselves or themselves under the covers at night. There was a regressive aspect here. The total isolation, the fantasy being of being enclosed within a second skin. Even in contemporary habits about love making, you have this wish to be totally enclosed. Making love in a bed means shutting yourself away. How do people make love today? We don't know. You never see in books. We need sociologists to work on this. To make love in bed, it's not just being horizontal, but there is a symbolic meaning. You are enclosed under the bed covers. And to go back to Plato's myth, it calls up the idea of the androgynous being made of two. For Melanie, burying herself deeply was a source of happiness. She gave this absolute whole her name. Several names she gave. She called this, if you've read it, a dear little grotto. When she was taken to hospital, she said, do anything you like, but don't take me away from my dear little grotto. And then she would say, the dear, good, great back. And she had a peculiar, incoherent, made-up language. A dear, good, back, mill in plaster. My dear, great, back, malampia. She had invented that name, Malampia. The thing we're describing here, absolute enclosure, is a concept. It's a concept because it has a name. This is the name that she created. Melanie is a logothete. Hence, we can call Malampianism any movement of affect, however fleeting, that compares the subject to bury himself or herself, to cover themselves up, to obliterate the world. We know that society suppresses Malampianism. The law has wrenched her, has wrenched Melanie from a dear little grotto. She's made to live in daylight, in a hospital bed, cleanly and religiously. I don't want to give you a pseudo-psychiatric or pseudo-psychoanalytic explanation of those types of madness associated with reclusion. I merely note that the clinic has a great deal to say about claustrophobia, but says nothing about claustrophilia or claustromania. Yet claustrophilia may be more important and be a more common experience. Personally, at any rate, I observe traces of this in myself. I like to create enclosed spaces to work in, to live in, to sleep in, protected by winding paths, fortifications. to bring this to a close, I'd like to point up two archetypal forms of the enclosed space. I mention them only because they are paradoxical in that they appear to be open, but they are in fact archetypes of closure. The first form is the labyrinth. The labyrinth. I almost began this seminar with the seminar on the labyrinth. It's a very rich theme. There's a whole aesthetics of the labyrinth. It's a very multivalent theme. It symbolizes the paradoxal work through which the subject can wall himself or herself up within a system. It is the archetypal space of the obsessional. The labyrinth is the space of active enclosure, to be opposed to the locked cell. Is the opposite of the cell. There is a constant work to try and get out of it. You work on your own walling up. The subject works endlessly, expends futile efforts in finding the way out. In the subject's effort to find the exit, he or she exacerbates the imprisonment. Labyrinth is a system that's hermetically sealed by its autonomy. In a love affair, we could say there is, once you're inside, no way out, and yet the labor required is immense. To get out of the labyrinth, you need an almost magical act, or the glimpse of a different system through which you have to pass. This is what the thread of Ariane symbolizes. What's interesting in that the space of the labyrinth, the impossibility of getting out of it, is a space without a ceiling. It's in the open air. There's no roof. The ancient mythical labyrinth has no roof. You see this very well in Fellini's Satyricon. It means that for somebody who looks on from the outside, from above, the solution is obvious. You can laugh looking at the hero who fails to get out of it. This is a situation typical of a love affair. The second form of the enclosed space, which is the antithesis of the labyrinth, but could be even more archetypal, is that of the desert. We go back to our Christian oriental culture. The desert is said Eremos in Greek, hence Eremus hermit. The hermit is one who lives in the desert. The anachoritic desert points up the fundamental ambivalence of enclosure. There is a joyous space of solitude, of calm, in which we see the influence of Hellenism. Hezukia would be the term here. Inner space, inner calm. At the same time, B, you have the idea of demonic, sterile connotation. This is not the Hellenistic representation, it's the Egyptian and the Semitic representation. Both are found in the Christian desert. In the biblical culture, this was a reality. The desert, Eremus, belonged to the culture of the time. For a Christian of that time, the desert was the Sinai, was where Moses would go, where Eli, John the Baptist would go to. The desert is not only a place, it is an existential theme. There is a vita eremitica. It can be experienced with varying degrees of intensity. There is an ultimate degree of intensity, which is what identifies the desert with total reclusion. It's called Paneremos, the absolute desert, the whole desert. Paneremos is what Saint Anthony experienced. We could say it's the superlative form of Malampianism. Paneremos is like Melanie's blanket. Since we have a little time left to get some rest, I'll take a simple figure. This will bring some quiet, because just a few facts will be brought to us by the colony of anachorites. I hesitated a little before giving you this figure, but let me recall that it's important to understand anachoritism. We have to see it doesn't go back too early. Anachorite, and nothing to do with catastrophe. Away from the world. The anachorite is animated by wish to retire. It's a little like the term used for the hippies, the dropouts, those who want to drop everything, who desert the ranks, by opposition to the drop-ins, those who fall in somewhere. The anachorite is not necessarily somebody who lives alone. Let's remember this. especially in idiorhythmic colonies. You have two types, the Scites on Mount Athos, in the idiorhythmic we studied, and what we saw sketchily, the Béguinage. Here are four more figures, rapidly. First, let me mention a sect, an anachorite sect, called the Qumran sect. Let me write it. Qumran. I will quote the text. It's a pre-Christian sect, Jewish. It's interesting to have a figure that is pre-Christian, the Qumran sect, comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls that were discovered in the spring of 1947. In those manuscripts, we have the Manual of Discipline, we have the Hebrew text, which is the roll of the rule. It was a small group of men living in retreat in the Judah desert at Qumran. It was around 140 BC. They were slaughtered by the Romans in 66 AD. You had 12 laymen and 3 priests that led to 12 tribes and the 3 Levitical clans. It was an Israel in miniature. Then there was an influx of volunteers, new buildings. Why this flight to the desert? That's interesting. It was a sect that was legalistic, we might say orthodox, like Monseigneur Lefebvre. They wanted a strict interpretation of the law. They moved away from the territory of Israel because they opposed the political and religious authorities in Jerusalem. They disagreed about the calendar. The authorities in Jerusalem wanted to do away with the traditional liturgical calendar. They wanted to replace it with the Hellenistic moon-sun calendar, because they were attached to their traditions, they went to the desert. There was a sectarian, predominantly sacerdotal group. They insisted on ritual purity, no contact with impious men, not even Jews. There was a communal living, there was a sharing of possessions, a period of 3 years of novitiate, and there were punishments. This is a relatively rare case, a right-wing marginality, more orthodox than Jerusalem then. Today it would be more on the left than on the right. The second colony I like to mention is the colony of the Nitriots, the monks of Nitria. It's a region of Egypt, Nitria, south of Alexandria, to the west of the Nile, and they were there in the 4th century. It was a vast colony of 5,000 Anachorites. 600 of them lived in the desert. Each hermit could live in absolute solitude. There was an enormous distance between each other. But they could also visit one another. You had a centralized service, and they had a number of places where they could bake bread, 7 bread ovens. There was a large central church, a guest house that could receive guests for unlimited periods of time. The guest would work in the kitchen, in the garden, in the bakery. Food was just bread and salt and an evening meal. They would spend 6 days in the cell. The monks would weave baskets. While doing this, they would meditate, recite the scriptures. That was a practice called melete in Greek. On Saturdays, everyone would go to church. They had a communal meal called agape, and they would pray through the night from Saturday to Sunday. That was the exact idiorhythmic model, a balance between solitude and contact with other people. Third colony of Anachorets, the Christian case, the Carthusians. They were the successors of the solitaries of Egypt. Maybe you know all this better than I do. I only learned recently that this order was founded in 1084 by Bruno, who was born in Cologne, and who founded a colony of solitaires in the valley of the Grand Chartreuse. It was a vast domain, very definite boundaries. We find here everything I said about enclosures. There is a desert there, which was the bottom of the valley. It was a narrow pass that was easily blocked. You have here the low house, occupied by brothers, that is, farmers, craftsmen. You have the high house with the father's monastery. There is an important liturgical service. That's interesting for us. Each father had his own individual cella, a small house. It was not just a cell. On the ground floor, you had a woodshed, a workshop. On the first floor, 2 rooms, a room called the Ave Maria,
was a private kitchen. This was abolished in 1276, where the monks would cook, and another room for prayer, where the monk would read, eat, and sleep. Next to it was a small garden and a veranda in case of bad weather. The principle was solitude. Prayers were carried out in the cella. They would go to church collectively at night. There were two services in the morning and in the afternoon. There was a meal taken collectively on Sundays. Every week, they had a communal walk. Note that there was a social division, brothers versus fathers, and then the individuation of the living space. See the brothers Karamazov. Father Zosima doesn't live in a monastery, but in the skite, a little house set apart. What's more interesting is that you have the individuation of food. It's interesting to see that in the first two centuries, this order rejected conviviality. We could sketch a typology here. Those who like to eat alone and those who like to eat with others. Some people prefer eating alone. At least the first Carthusian wanted to eat alone. Just a few words now about the fourth case. The solitaire of Port-Royal. It was a formless community. The solitaires would not have any profession, no vows, no dress code, not even a stable place of abode. They lived together in accordance with ordinary and general freedom. They are friends. There was no institutional basis. The idea originated with Saint-Cyran. He had been inspired by the Carthusian rule. It was a purely empirical grouping at Port-Royal, starting in the summer of 1637. Then there was a project, a utopia, the vision of Duc de Luynes. His domain was just next to Port-Royal. He thought he was going to build 12 beguinages, 12 hermitages for selected gentlemen. There again, you find the 12 tribes around the tabernacle. In the event of their death, they would be replaced by a successor, would be pre-approved. That would be an ideal image of Zion. Let's note that despite its Christian Jansenist aspects, what is remarkable is that the founding ethos that is professed, much repeated, of the group is friendship. We have to distinguish between the determination and the telos. The determination is the perfection of life, but the telos is friendship. That's it.